Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we are taking a deep dive into the latest news about Kaspersky and its alleged ties to Russian security services. The New York Times has just published an absolutely blockbuster piece that claims Israeli intelligence infiltrated Kaspersky's network in 2014 and uncovered slam dunk evidence. The company was operating espionage campaigns on behalf of the Russian government. We'll jump into that in a minute. Then in this week's feature, I'll chat with Dave Itell of Immunity Inc. and get his feelings on the Kaspersky controversy as well. Casey Ellis is this week's sponsor guest. He's joining us this week to talk about how people running their own bug bounties can avoid false negatives or, you know, discarding valid reports. A couple of weeks back, we ran a feature here on the show about a guy who had a pretty hard time reporting a legitimate security bug to Microsoft. Casey will be along with some ideas on how companies might do better when managing a lot of inbound bug reports, many of which are bogus. How do you sort the wheat from the chaff? But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And mate, it has been an absolutely huge week in the cybers. So let's kick it off with the big news item, Kaspersky. Now, it started with this sensational Wall Street Journal piece about Kaspersky being used as like a tool of Russian intelligence, but it was pretty vague stuff. But just within the last hour, the New York Times has published an absolutely blockbuster piece that says the United States moved against Kaspersky because they got owned by Israeli intelligence in 2014, and Israeli intelligence caught them using their AV platform as basically a giant search and exfil botnet. I mean, these are sensational claims.
Yeah, now this really is a pretty big story now, isn't it? I mean, we had some idea that obviously there was something going on with Kaspersky, but the idea that the US government would ban it and all that kind of thing, we were wondering what it was. But yeah, this ties together a lot of things, a lot of pieces of the story into a coherent and pretty scary narrative. Those of you who remember a couple of years back when Kaspersky announced that they had been owned by some nation state actor who was very interested in what they were doing with their research on the Equation Group and the Regen botnet at the time, turns out that was the Israelis. And we've just, the New York Times is running a piece that attributes confirmation of that to current and former Israeli government officials. And it turns out, yes, they decided to go have a look and see what Kaspersky knew. And yeah, turns out it was Russian intelligence using Kaspersky's tooling and pulling stuff straight back onto Russian intelligence systems, using, as you said, Kaspersky's systems and software as one big botnet, which... Yeah, wow. I mean, yeah.
Look, I just want to read a quote from the piece here. It says, Israeli intelligence officers informed the NSA that in the course of their Kaspersky hack, they uncovered evidence that Russian government hackers were using Kaspersky's access to aggressively scan for American government classified programs and pulling any findings back to Russian intelligence systems. They provided their NSA counterparts with solid evidence of the Kremlin campaign in the form of screenshots and other documentation, according to people briefed on the events. I mean, these are just sensational claims.
Yeah, and unfortunately it does kind of tie together a whole bunch of of other bits of the story, and kind of seems believable. I mean, we haven't really seen this kind of detail yet. It's what we've been asking for, and here it is, and the story really doesn't look good. And I mean, it's not clear from what we know at the moment whether or not Kaspersky the company is kind of complicit in this, whether it's they've been owned and they're just being used, or whether or not up to the leadership level, whether Eugene Kaspersky, for example, is in fact a tool of the a willing tool of the Russian intelligence apparatus, or whether it's just people who are employed by Kaspersky without necessarily the actual company approving of it, on behalf of the national government.
It hardly matters, does it? Right? I mean, when it comes to deciding whether or not to use these products, it does not matter whether or not they are witting or unwitting. It's the same as the Huawei thing, right? There's no world in which that distinction really matters. But it seems to me that what they might be doing is just using things like hidden signatures, looking for keywords like TSSCI or NoFawn or various program names, like NSA program names or whatever. I mean, this story too, one thing that's a bit odd is this story says that this does not relate to Vault 7 or Shadow Brokers, which I do find interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting twist, and it's kind of hard to say what that's based on. I mean, hopefully the rest of the story is accurate, and this bit perhaps therefore is, you know, got something to it as well. But yeah, it's hard to know, I guess, how you would conclude that. But yeah, maybe we will see some more revelations that do explain, you know, how these various leaks related to each other or don't relate to each other, you know, as this unfolds. But yeah, like, I don't know. I mean, what do you conclude from this? I mean, Kaspersky really has to be. I think as you tweeted, it has to be pretty much toast after this, right? I mean, how can you survive in the Western world after this? And then, of course, and then immediately begs the question, well, what about everybody else? You know, why, if they're willing to own Kaspersky, you know, a company that is in their own country and use that as a collection tool, why not own Symantec or McAfee?
Well, 2017 is the year of the supply chain attack, right? So, well, I mean,
exactly.
And also, don't forget that we saw not so long ago the arrest of a Kaspersky investigator who's ex-FSB. He was arrested and charged with treason. He's still under lockup. I don't know if that trial has started yet, but you've got to wonder how this ties into it. You know, it's got to be an element in this whole mess, you would think.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, because I mean, that relationship between you know, the FSB and Kaspersky and the staff and some of the other you know, kind of sort of not quite government but doing government bidding hacking crews in Russia. Yeah, like that's an interesting story, and yeah, I don't know. We don't know what's actually going on there yet. But yeah, as you say, it's almost certainly going to be involved somehow, isn't it?
It's interesting too, because this was a bit of a moving target, this story. The Wall Street Journal first reported that this was a outside contractor who had this information on their computer in this single case that they've identified. But it's now been revealed that that person actually worked at TAO, which begs the question: A, why were you taking your work home with you? And B, what the hell were you doing running any cloud AV platform if you're going to bring all your top secret work home? What are you thinking?
No, exactly. Yeah, I know. Like, surely you go to classes where you get told to take OBSEC seriously when you work at TAO. Like, surely there's, you know, mandatory webinars you have to attend or something.
Yes, webinars. Webinars will save us. But yeah, gee, just what an incredible story this is. And I just think we are going to witness the imminent implosion of Kaspersky. I mean, they are just cooked. And that is such a shame. I mean, Kaspersky's been a sponsor of this podcast in years gone by. Do you know what I mean? I went on a Kaspersky junket some years ago to St. Petersburg, you know. I've met, you know, Eugene a bunch of times. I've always found him to be a lovely guy, and the people who work for him just love him. It's a company with a really positive culture, and some of the smartest anti-malware people I've ever met in my life work at Kaspersky, and their product is incredible for not being rubbish. And to see this, look, I mean, they're going to get toasted, and if these allegations are true, which on the surface of it they certainly feel like they are, you know, the company deserves to sort of wither and die. But it's a damn shame for the people who work there.
Yeah, no, it really is, because I mean, Kaspersky's AV tech, as you said, like, is very much at the top of the industry. I mean, they are very, very good at what they do, and yeah, you certainly get the feel. I've never met Eugene, but you certainly get the feel from that, you know, kind of cadre of old school AV guys, you know, Eugene and Mikko Hipponen and Peter Zohr and, you know, some of those old school dudes. Like, they really did get into antivirus because they actually cared. You kind of get that vibe off them. And yeah, it is a real pity to see, you know, really good quality work get torched in geopolitics, which is kind of what's happening here. So yeah, now we've got a lot of sympathy, despite us being, I guess, pretty harsh about Kaspersky because of this. But yeah, like, for the people who work there and work on the products, this must be a f***ing awful time.
Yeah, and you know, my take on Eugene has always been that he's like a super nice guy, but he's actually a little bit naive. God, I'd really like to know how this came together and what the extent of his involvement was. And I mean, there's still so many questions, but you know, just any way you slice it, any way you dice it, I mean, this is it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I agree with you. And I guess, you know, I personally would hope that, like, this was happening behind his back, just for, you know, from at a personal level, because it would just be such a, I don't know, just be such a kick in the guts, you know. And I feel, I feel sorry. I'd like to feel sorry for the guy.
Yeah. Well, look, we're going to move on to some other news here now, and a bit of controversy here in Australia. It turns out that the Queensland Police Service was running the child exploitation website Child's Play. I mean, this was one of those Onion Service websites. They were running it for about a year, and they continued to post abusive images on the board to sort of maintain the illusion that it was still under the control of, you know, actual paedophiles. This has caused a lot of controversy, mostly because of the duration for which they were operating the website, and also the fact that they continued to post images, hence sort of re-victimizing people who'd already been made victims by pedophiles. I mean, it's a big story, this one.
Yeah, and it's a really difficult one because you can absolutely see both sides, and both sides have very, very legitimate arguments. I mean, you know, obviously the police would like to stop, the side would like to arrest the maximum number of people possible, and running it for a while is the right way to do that. But on the other hand, as you say, right, they are re-uploading and reposting and continuing to facilitate the exchange of abuse images, and that's also horrible. And I don't know that there's a – like, it's one of these things where there really is no good choice to make.
No.
And I'm sure they must – I mean, the police must have agonized about what to do.
Oh, they do. I mean, you and I would both know people who've worked in these sort of jobs, right? And they don't take sort of stuff lightly. They're not YOLO about it. But they can become a little bit single-minded when it comes to getting into these sorts of investigations and – you know, maybe take things a little bit too far. I mean, the one thing that really sticks out here is the playpen case in the United States. That was a 2-month operation. This was a 12-month operation. And you just sort of wonder, well, how long is too long? And I guess from the police point of view, is they're probably snaring an IP or some sort of identifying bit of information, maybe, you know, a few times a month, and they don't want to shut it down because they've still got, they're still IDing perps as the longer they do the operation, right? So how do you do that? Like,
it's obviously a very, very difficult calculus to make. I think in this case, what the site had 3,000 active users of the million or so accounts, and they haven't really made clear how many of those people they've now subsequently arrested or picked up or whatever. And I guess that maybe that's the metric by which you have to judge it, but
it's also the deterrence, right? Yeah. Because, you know, if you're someone who spends time on, you know, these types of onion sites, like you're now going to be thinking, well, geez, I mean, this could be not only run by the police, but it may have been run by the police for the last year.
Well, yeah, I guess in that respect, it does have hopefully a chilling effect on the entire underground in that way. So, yeah, I don't know. This is a hard decision, and I'm glad it's not mine.
It is indeed a tough one. Turning our attention to North Korea now, and apparently, now this happened late last year. There was apparently the North hacked the South, but it looks like they obtained 235 gigabytes of sensitive data. I mean, that's a glowing endorsement of South Korea's fiber infrastructure right there. but yeah, they got 235 gig, including procedures for decapitation raids in North Korea, war plans, all sorts of stuff. Like, this stuff, it's the sort of stuff you wouldn't want the North to get. This is bad.
Yeah, no, this does, on the face of it, seem very, very bad. This was a politician from the ruling party in South Korea revealed that, yeah, they had had their some of their defense systems broken into, 200 gigabytes of stuff taken, including joint plans with the Americans and other allies for all sorts of stuff relating to, you know, doing war to North Korea, which, like, that's got to make a lot of people really, really upset, I imagine, in the military world. Because, I mean, it's one thing, to know that there are – North Koreans are out there doing this kind of hacking. But having this sort of stuff stolen, you know, really is not a good look, and not good for, you know, the safety of, the people who may or may not end up fighting on either side of the war, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I wonder why the North are accelerating their weapons program, right? Like, you've got to think would factor
exactly
in.
Right.
So once you're reading documents that detail like 600 different ways to kill you, it might make you want to have all the nukes. And speaking of North Korean nukes, Andy Greenberg has a nice little write-up in Wired talking about how difficult it actually is to run cyber operations against the North Korean nuclear program, just really by virtue of how offline the program is.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it must be comparable to trying to, you know, hack the Manhattan Project in the 40s, you know, when you don't actually have any computers involved, like they're all doing it by hand with slide rules or something. But no, I mean, it really, you know, does illustrate the very, very, you know, vast difference between the vulnerability of Americans to having cyber done to them and the vulnerability of North Koreans, which is to say very little by comparison because of the lack of technology and because of the amount of air gaps and the fact that they, you know, really don't have ubiquitous internet there. And I imagine also not a culture that supports, you know, shadow IT like we do in the West, where you're just used to kind of getting around all of the pesky rules by just, you know, sorting out your own infrastructure when you need it, shoving it in the cloud or whatever. I imagine that happens much less often in the North Korean military industrial complex than it does in the West for a number of reasons.
Not too many of their contractors are running Kaspersky AV on their fabulous home internet connection, you know. That is not a thing that happens.
Exactly.
Exactly. Oh, now Ars Technica is running a story here. You know, some time ago, the Security and Exchange Commission in the United States, the SEC, they actually got owned. And I spoke about that a few weeks ago with the Gruck when he was filling in for you. But it turns out that at the time they got owned, you know, the internal forensic investigative unit was using like hard drives that other business units were throwing away because they were so old and they were desperately underfunded. And this has sort of emerged now. But I mean, this is a common story, isn't it? When you see there's been some major incident at an organization like this and it turns out, well, guess what? Parts of your, you know, your protection teams or whatever have been grossly underfunded. And it certainly appears to be the case in this instance.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the classic story, isn't it? Like, you're not going to get funding for internal, you know, threat hunting and detection and incident response when you don't find any incidents. And you're not going to find any incidents until you get funding, and so until someone actually owns you in a way that forces the organization to discover that they've been owned, you know, usually through a third party. Until that happens, you don't get any budget. And that does seem to be the sort of story that's happened here. I think the forensics team actually were talking to the Inspector General of the SEC and complained that their entire hardware budget for the year was $100,000, which does seem a little bit low for an organization with the responsibilities that the SEC has.
Yeah, and handling that sort of information as well. So, yeah, well, I'm guessing they got a budget kick since then. So you would hope. You would hope. Now, Joseph Cox over at Daily Beast has written up a great story here. Lovely headline too. Meet Danny, the guy authorities say is selling encrypted phones to organized crime. And really what he's doing is he's looking into this new cottage industry where people are selling modified phones, either Androids or Blackberries or whatever, and selling services to go along with them. And their target market really is organized crime. And I kind of think this is a good sign. I mean, if people say, oh, you know, why would you deal with encryption on major platforms as an issue for law enforcement when people will just go off and use these sorts of things? You want people using these sort of things because these companies, their infrastructure can be seized, they can be investigated. But anyway, this is an interesting story. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting story because, as you alluded, right, I mean, this actually kind of self-selects criminals into one place where you can target them, because by and large, the companies that are building these devices and selling them are all useless at it and you know, build their tools badly, build their infrastructure badly, don't focus on the things that actually matter, and you end up trading off, you know, network comms, which is only a fraction of your problem, for centralizing all of your stored, you know, data at rest in a place that you can't trust anymore. So yeah, like, it seems like a really good thing because criminals are dumb and giving dumb people their money, and then they're all going to get owned in one place, which is what's happened to a few of these providers. So,
and I think just as criminal awareness has grown around stuff like the type of spyware that is deployed against common platforms, they're increasingly seeking out solutions like this, and that can only be a fantastic thing.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, if they just went out and bought a goddamn iPhone, like retail, and paid actual money for it instead of trying to cheap out and get rubbish Androids or rubbish Blackberries, then they wouldn't have this problem. I mean, they'd have a separate problem, but it would be a different problem at least. And probably
I don't know that these things are cheap, to be honest, Adam.
Well, okay, not, yeah. I mean, I guess I mean cheap in the sense that they're not very good quality as opposed to cheap in that they don't cost money, because obviously you're paying a premium to be ripped off by the people who are selling you these things, but yes.
But they are selling them with things like, you know, the cameras and microphones taken out and stuff like that, so they're just used for messaging. It's an interesting little look inside that cottage industry. So links are in this week's show notes, as always. But speaking of iPhones, Cellbrite has said that, you know, owning iPhones is just getting harder and harder and harder and harder. So, you know, this is an increasing problem for law enforcement. It's something that we've covered for years, but it's interesting to see, you know, the company that is best known for providing unlock solutions to law enforcement actually come out and say, yeah, this is getting harder.
Although the funny thing is, the technical director of Cellbrite was giving a talk, and he said to some customers, he said that, you know, it is getting harder and Apple's doing a good job of it and we're finding it much more difficult to break into it. And then that the video of that talk got put up, and then once it got written up, they've immediately got rid of the video again, because I guess it's not very good marketing to say we're not actually able to do it anymore for modern phones. But yeah, that's kind of a little funny twist of it.
Oh, now this is something we discussed in the most recent soapbox I did with Proofpoint, but a trick that is getting attackers of quite far these days, it's very fashionable, is to actually just drop into existing email threads and insert malware into them, because it's like next level spear phishing. And you know, this has become such a big thing that, you know, I'm even looking at a news story about it, Adam. But geez, what a cool technique!
Yeah, Adam, it is a technique that makes a lot of sense, eh? Where you either hack a few mailboxes at your target customer or in a related, you know, company they do business with, or own a domain that's in the same sort of position, and then, yeah, pick up midway through some ongoing conversations and use that trust that's already built by virtue of it being a real conversation to then drop your, you know, your malware document or fish for credentials or, you know, whatever other thing you're trying to do. So, yeah, seems like a pretty smart technique. Obviously, it requires a little more work in terms of setup. Because you have to go actually own some stuff. But it's a really good way to turn the first few creds that you've got that aren't much use into, you know, being able to attack more privileged people in the organization that the people you've already owned might be communicating with. So, yeah, no, it's a smart technique.
Discus has confirmed a 2012 database breach, which apparently impacted 17.5 million users. So does this mean we can dox people for making their awful, awful comments?
Perhaps so, actually. Yeah, we haven't seen the actual data being leaked, but apparently it does include usernames and passwords salted with a single iteration of SHA-1, which is not particularly great. But yeah, I'm not sure whether that means we can decloak rubbish commenters on blogs that use Discus or not, but I'm sure some people will be giving it a try if they've got hold of the data. So far, I think Have I Been Pwned has a copy of it, but I haven't seen the actual raw data set, although clearly if it's got breached in 2012, it's probably been kicking around the underground for some time.
White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, apparently his personal phone was compromised. That's according to a report from Politico, but I got to say, I find it a little bit hard to get excited because the original reporting around this was pretty vague. And, you know, for all we know, I mean, he apparently complained that his phone wasn't getting software updates and app updates and he was just having a bit of trouble with it and apparently it was compromised. But whether or not he was mining Monero or Dogecoin or whether or not it was the Russians, like, we have no idea. I suspect if it was something serious, like, we probably wouldn't know about it, you know?
Yeah, like, it is very hard to say. He might have just had some, you know, rubbish App Store malware or something that was, you know, doing ad injection or something, which, you know, no one knew that it was the Chief of Staff of the White House. But what a world we live in, isn't it?
It is. Forrester, which is a research house, which is kind of known for doing a fair bit in InfoSec as well. It's a market research and investment advisory firm. They got owned some time ago, and attackers gained access to a lot of their reports and stuff. I don't think this is a terribly big deal.
Well, no, but I'm sure for them, you know, in terms of their business model, it's probably quite an important thing. But that's the main thing that you do is selling these reports. And there's plenty of those that are, you know, for industry groups or things that are not necessarily for public distribution. So I imagine they feel rather silly having all of their stuff stolen. But yeah, on the, you know, range of breaches and things that have been owned in the last few years, does seem on the low end of severity by comparison to, you know, everything else.
In some ironic news, people who were installing, you know, something that purported to be Adblock Plus as a Google Chrome extension were in fact installing Adware, which is kind of, I don't know, it's kind of funny, isn't it?
The thing is, okay, I mean, so someone registered an account called Adblock Plus on the Chrome store and published a plugin called Adblock Plus, presumably with some Unicode tricks or something to make it look like a real, you know, the real thing. People were installing it, you know, I think 30, 40, 50,000 users, something like that. And then the funny thing is, like, the first thing it does when you install it is it starts popping ads, which the sort of people who've just installed Adblock are probably going to notice, like, at least wait a week. You know, be patient. Don't do that immediately. Yeah, like, that, in terms of, you know, great idea, bad follow-through, no biscuit for you, whoever did this.
Now, NIST and the Department of Homeland Security in the United States is getting ready to tackle the what I would probably describe as the untackleable. apparently, they're looking at trying to introduce standards around secure inter-domain routing. So this is designed to prevent BGP hijacks. Now, I haven't looked at this stuff in some years, but I remember the last time I looked at it was a bloke who worked for Arbor Networks. And I'm talking like 8-9 years ago. I saw him do a presentation in Europe about BGP and some of the approaches around securing it. And it really didn't look like it was doable back then. Does it look doable now, Adam? Because I suspect probably not.
Well, I mean, it seems like it's doable in the sense that DNSSEC is doable, except the DNSSEC has probably less complexity and less moving parts and less people involved. Yeah, like, it's one of those things that, like, clearly we actually do need. But my God, actually doing it is going to be a pain in the ass. What they're proposing is a collection of a number of technologies that basically try to bolt PKI and you know, sort of origin verification into BGP and into the way we announce networks. And it's just so complicated and requires so many people to get so many things right that, you know, if it was easy, we would already have done it. And I feel sadly that it's going to be in the same category as DNSSEC and, you know, IPsec, opportunistic IPsec in the base IPv6 standard. Like, these are things that would be nice to have that, frankly, are just never actually going to happen.
They require too much will. That's the problem.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, the thing is, right, okay, let's say we did it. Like, let's say we solved BGP hijacking and it was no longer a thing. Does that solve the problem? No, you're just going to go own the ISP and announce it through the legitimate BGP SEC authorized infrastructure, right? I mean, it's not like it's hard to own an ISP.
Yeah, no, right? I know. I mean, and that's why I think we should just really be focusing our energy on TLS, right? I mean, because that's you know, the success of TLS. I mean, we always throw shit at it, but the fact that TLS has been so successful and the CA model, you know, love it or hate it, it has actually kicked the can down the road further than something like DNS has when, you know, when we've applied it to web traffic. So I kind of feel like, hey, let's just stick with that and try to refine that instead of trying to, like, have cryptographically assured BGP routes that is just going to make things really inflexible and hard, you know?
Yeah, and I think I do think you make a solid point there. I mean, we have to assume that the network is untrusted. BGP is one of the many ways it can be untrusted. Doing end-to-end crypto with TLS is one of the ways that we get around that problem, regardless of whether it's BGP or the ISP getting owned or you're using Cafe Wireless or whatever other problem you've got. So yeah, I think that makes makes for sane advice, despite the fact that, as you say, TLS has its challenges as well. I don't know. Like, it would be nice to have. It would be nice if we could do this thing this right. But I really think, like, what we've done so far to deal with BGP hijacking, which is detecting when people do hijack stuff quickly, and a lot of work's been done on that, and that's actually quite effective. It doesn't stop it, but at least you know it happened.
Yeah.
And that seems like a much more achievable approach than doing it properly.
Russia looks like the latest country to ban cryptocurrency exchanges following China's moves to do the same. This is a pretty big deal. I think, you know, we could be seeing a lot of countries just cracking down. You know, this is probably bad for people who are holding a lot of Bitcoin, you would think.
Yeah, but there seems to be a lot of hostility from governments towards Bitcoin. And not really, I guess, for the reasons that, you know, the Bitcoin enthusiasts would originally have thought, which I mean is just kind of being generally scared about having the monetary system usurped out of their control. It's more about the fact that it is being used for fraud and laundering and nothing much good. And yeah, there's a lot of hostility. And yeah, Russia is another country that's moving towards making it problematic to use Bitcoin. That's, yeah, it's got to be bad for people who are investing and hold lots of it.
Adam, we've actually got a genuine comedy bug to report on this week. It's about a week old now, but it's Mac, Mac OS High Sierra. Please tell us about this wonderful bug.
So apparently in one of the particular ways that you could set up disk crypto on High Sierra in your new APFS volume, if you entered a password hint along, you know, so you enter your password to crypto the volume and you enter a password hint to remind yourself in the future, apparently somewhere in the code they accidentally used the value of the password for what they stored as the password hint. So then when you asked for a hint, it would just tell you what the password was, which, yeah, kind of dumb.
How long was that in there? Because you'd think that's the sort of thing that's going to get noticed pretty quickly.
Well, you would, wouldn't you? Yeah. So I know it's not clear how long that's been in there. And certainly when we tried to repro it here in the office, we struggled to figure out what method of encrypting your disks, like during install or after the fact or whatever. Like, we couldn't repro it, so I don't know exactly what, you know, how many installs were vulnerable to this, but what a stupid bug. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Lorenzo over at Motherboard wrote what I would probably call a pretty ho-hum story about T-Mobile leaking user data. The reason I want to talk about it, though, is he updated that story after he wrote it. Someone got in touch with him and showed him his own data, right? So to prove that they, you know, that they actually knew about this bug. But then they let it slip that a bunch of people were using this to do SIM swaps, which is a great way to bypass SMS two-factor authentication. And, you know, the reason I find this so interesting is because for so long, you know, we've relied on SMS two-factor, and that just pushes the authentication burden onto telcos. And do you really want them being authentication brokers, right? Like, you do not. And this is proof.
Yeah, like trusting the telco to be, you know, the root of your identity chain. This is a great example of why you probably shouldn't. And the thing I liked about this story, as you say, like the plot twist at the end when he updates it is great. The funny thing I found with this is, of course, so this guy found a website where you could enter your phone number and you get a bunch of details back, pointed out you could scrape it all, reported to T-Mobile. They said, thanks for telling us, here's $1,000 under our bug bounty, but don't worry, no one's ever used it, which is exactly what every company that's ever been breached always says. And then, yeah, the fact that then someone turns around and says, actually, there's a video on YouTube showing people how to do this from 3 months ago, and this data is like being used in the wild and the underground for actual badness. Yeah, like, stick that up your T-Mobile. Maybe you should go actually do some you know, incident response before you tell people to get free credit monitoring and piss off. So,
yeah, telcos. Yeah, so that that one turned out to be a little bit more interesting than I originally thought. So there you go. And Adam, one of your countrymen has just reported a blockbuster bug in Windows.
Yeah, old mate Nick Freeman, previously of SecurityAssessment.com here in New Zealand, now moved to Bishop Fox in New York, has found a set of memory corruption bugs in the Windows DNS client. So that if you're the direct upstream DNS server and you can generate malformed DNS responses, you can like straight up exec code on the Windows. Which, dang, that's a sweet bug on Windows 8, Windows 10 as well, Windows Server 2012 and 2016. So like those are very real bugs for people who are in a place where a malicious DNS server can answer you, so on public networks, that kind of thing. Like, this is a good bug. And yeah, it's a combination of heap overflows and some integer wraparound-y sort of stuff. Great work with the old fuzzer there, Nick. And yeah, Microsoft, I guess, are going to have to patch these. But yeah, some sweet bugs.
Yeah, I bumped into Nick actually at KiwiCon last year. And, you know, this is fantastic work. So he must be feeling very happy about it. So well done, Nick. And finally, Adam, you know, last week we started the news bulletin saying, wow, I didn't know those DDoS attacks against, you know, against financial institutions were Iran. Well, it turns out like everybody else did, because I got a couple of emails pointing at one of them linking to the actual indictment against the people who were conducting this attack on behalf of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. So, yeah, it turns out those attacks back in, I think, 2012, it was well known that they were conducted on behalf of the Iranian government. So there you go. Bowl me over. I had no idea.
Yeah. We got good in school, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We got proper school.
In our defense, we see a lot of things get a lot of owned, and, yeah, we maybe forget a few of them, clearly.
It all blurs into one cavalcade of ownage after a decade and a bit, you know, like... Yeah, anyway. But, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Look, thanks a lot for joining us to discuss all that. It's, you know, what a blockbuster week for news. So cheers for that, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting week, eh, that Kaspersky stuff. Man, interesting times we live in. And, yeah, we'll see what happens next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, Eugene Kaspersky has taken to Twitter to say he's launching an internal investigation into the allegations outlined in the New York Times piece. He is very much claiming he had no idea, which is kind of funny when you think about it, because they caught the Israelis, but now they're claiming another group infiltrated them and used their product essentially as a botnet, and they didn't notice. I mean, I don't know if he knew, but you'd think someone would notice that. Now, whether or not he knew doesn't really matter, though, does it? I mean, if they have lost control of their product ecosystem, well, that is reason enough not to use their product. Now, there's been a lot of to and fro on InfoSec Twitter on this over the last few days. Some people are saying, hey, you know, maybe they just identified malicious files and sent them to Kaspersky's cloud, and that's what the tool is designed to do. And hey, if that's what had happened here, I'd be 100% on Kaspersky's side. If, however, it turns out they've used hidden signatures for strings like NoFawn or TSSCI, and that seems to be what the New York Times story is alleging, then obviously I would not be on their side, because that would mean Kaspersky is operating a huge botnet, essentially designed to steal classified material. Now, it would also be very unfortunate if it turns out that Kaspersky has been compromised without the knowledge of its senior leadership. But again, look, whether the company has cooperated or not, it seems moot. The fact is, someone, a company staffer, an infiltrator, or a remote attacker, has been using Kaspersky's footprint to conduct espionage against the United States, and that will effectively kill its business. Dave Itell worked at NSA a million years ago, but these days he runs Immunity Inc. and the annual Infiltrate Conference, which is a favorite among people who specialize in exploitation. He joined me via Skype to talk about the Kaspersky controversy, and here's my short interview with Dave.
Kaspersky is an intelligence asset of the Russian government, and I'm amazed that we haven't seen action yet from the Australians and the Germans and the Brits to do exactly what the United States did, which is basically ban it. I mean, at the point where Best Buy pulls your product off the shelves, I mean, someone at Best Buy got a message and a briefing from a U.S. government official that said this has to go. And, you know, listening to Kaspersky, like, he clearly understands what the Americans are saying about his product, and he's pretending that he doesn't. And then on the other hand, he has, you know, 300 million reasons a year not to do exactly the behavior that they're accusing him of, except he probably thought he'd never get caught, right? And that's, I think, what we saw with a lot of these latest revelations, right? With even with like the Snowden revelations, a lot of that stuff, people are happy to do secret stuff for a government if they think they're not going to get caught. And, you know, he's unfortunately a casualty, I don't think, of the geopolitical pressure, because all this stuff, and he says it's geopolitical, but it all started in 2015. It has nothing to do with any of the modern stuff. So it's hard to believe what he's saying on Twitter and in his interviews. I listened to the S4 interview that he did as well. And it's, you know, 100 different integrators that he's integrated with, and they're all getting ripped out right now.
Do you understand why there are skeptics out there who are not prepared to condemn Kaspersky yet?
For sure. I mean, the skepticism is super healthy, but it's also a sign of, you know, how many bridges the government has burned in the information security industry. They historically have not treated the information security industry as a community worth political respect, essentially. And so we see that with attribution issues. No one would believe them when they said it was North Korea. No one believed them when they claimed that they found Kaspersky to be doing bad things. And the reason I don't think it's politics is who's involved. And this is a little bit of reading the tea leaves of American cyber policy. But you don't get Rubio and, you know, DERNSA and, or Director NSA. You don't get all the various, you know, there was a Democratic senator who wrote the op-ed in the Washington Post. All of these signals come from such a broad array of people who have no interest in, you know, escalating tensions with Russia, that, and they're not getting anything out of this. It's just literally about Kaspersky crossing a line. That's all it is.
It feels like every time someone gets a classified briefing on this, they feel compelled to write an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal or New York Times. You know, like, it does sort of have that feel to it.
Which essentially means the evidence is pretty solid internally. You know, I haven't had a briefing on it, but I know enough to read between the lines of who these people are and what they're trying to say. And they're saying, stop using Kaspersky antivirus. And that sucks for all the great people who work at Kaspersky antivirus. I mean, it's terrible for them, but it's true. They're not going to exist for much longer. I don't think the company exists anymore. I got to be honest. I mean, the American government doesn't directly tell American businesses what to do. But, you know, my business is all about the New York City financial market. And everyone there is literally pulling it out on a daily basis. Like, from all, not just it, but everything that has ever integrated with it or touches it or mentions it in its sales literature, which is a large part of what Kaspersky's business is licensing the AV engine to, you know, smaller players. Mm. So, you know, those big financials make, you know, that's a lot of money. And if you think, oh, I'm an integrator and I integrated with, you know, Kaspersky AV's engine because it's the best one, which may be true, but now I can't, I have to rip it out. Like, there's some contractual issues there that go pretty deep, and you don't get back into that market. And you can see where Huawei is in the American market to see a picture of where Kaspersky is going to be in a few years. And I don't see how this doesn't go international. You know, I don't see how the Israeli market, the European market, the Australian and New Zealand markets have Kaspersky in them at all in the future. I don't think there's any possibility that Kaspersky antivirus is not a signals intelligence tool.
That was Dave Itell of Immunity there, and yeah, I agree, it will be very difficult for Kaspersky to survive this. Okay, it is on to this week's sponsor interview now. A couple of weeks back, I interviewed a gentleman who'd found a fairly straightforward bug in Microsoft's Exchange Online Remote PowerShell module. He discovered it wasn't validating SSL certificates, and he wrote up a very clear report and sent it over. Now, the response, I've got to say, was pretty bad. Microsoft basically said, nope, this isn't an issue because it requires man in the middle. Yeah, I mean, it was that bad a response. Eventually, they sorted it out and the bug was patched, but obviously it was a less than ideal process. Well, this week's sponsor is BugCrowd, a company that knows a thing or two about triaging bug reports. So I wanted to ask BugCrowd's founder, chairman, and CTO, Casey Ellis, about how companies can make this process run a bit smoother. He joined me for this interview and we spoke about that. And we also took a bit of a look at how the CFAA, thankfully, hasn't turned out to be a disaster for the bug bounty industry yet. Here's Casey describing his reaction to our feature interview about that bug report.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear, you know, obviously how it started, hearing his perspective on it, and then how eventually it was corrected. None of it was really a surprise in terms of, you know, you actually called it out in the interview. Like, this type of thing happens a lot. I call it like SOC fatigue with companies that run their own programs or try to manage their own security out inbox. At the end of the day, you're dealing with a bunch of different levels of skill and a bunch of different people that are talking about different, you know, criticality of issue, from like the really severe to the, I don't even know what you're talking about. And doing that at scale for a long period of time, it causes fatigue. So, yeah, to hear that that was the initial reaction doesn't surprise me a whole ton. And, to also hear that the reaction once you got involved as someone who was kind of a intermediary in the mix, that the fact that that helped the process forward doesn't really surprise me either.
But see, that's the thing, right? Like, I would not claim that I was, you know, that I'm particularly well positioned more than anyone else who's vaguely known about in InfoSec to sort of help out on that. It seems to be that you, and this is what our interview subject was saying, right? Like, if no one's ever heard of you,
yeah,
coming in cold is kind of difficult, right? So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So yeah. What do you do as an organization to not make that mistake? That's the question.
Yeah. I mean, the really difficult thing about doing that is that, you know, false negatives are not really what you want in a disclosure program. Like, you don't want to say no to the wrong things. And, you know, what I've seen a lot of companies do that roll their own start to rely on pretty heavily over time is two things. One is the reputation of the researcher that's sending the issue in, which is exactly what you just talked about. The problem with that is that you end up with a negative bias against people that might have really important information but are unknown. And the other is looking for, you know, classic flags of things that might not be as important. What's interesting about this particular bug is that man in the middle as a descriptor of the attack vector is one of those classic, like, I can get root if I already have root type of issues that you see come through. Mm. And that it can deprioritize it in the mind doing triage.
Yeah,
they're seeing a lot of those.
I think I get what you mean, right? So they're seeing man in the middle and they're thinking, well, okay, that's not our problem. Do you know what I mean? If you get man in the middle, you get man in the middle. Whereas what this guy was actually saying is, if you get man in the middle, this thing isn't validating certificates. So that is a problem, right? So they just maybe dismissed it because they hit that key phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially. I mean, again, you know, what I don't know at this point is, was that mystery researcher well known or not? And you know, also is this exactly what happened in terms of how they received the report? But looking at the raw ingredients of how all that went down, those two things wouldn't surprise me if they were true.
So what are some concrete strategies you can employ to minimize the risks of this happening?
Well, you know, you just got to call 1-800-BUG-CROWD and we'll take care of it.
Yeah,
all
yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and it's partly, that is partly true. Like, we have done right since the beginning a lot of work to make sure that we're looking at everything that comes through and, you know, applying bias to make that more efficient, but not to the extent that we're, you know, saying no to things that we should be saying yes to. In terms of doing it yourself, I think it really comes down to, you know, making sure you've got good process and good rotation on your internal triage teams to make sure that people aren't just getting burnt out.
Yeah, I can imagine you wouldn't really want to be at the secure@microsoft.com inbox for more than a couple of days at a time, because you would just, you know, you would start making mistakes, because I reckon that, you know, that inbox would be flicking by at a pretty amazing rate, right? And most of it, 99% of it is going to be, you know, just nutso people reporting non-issues, right?
Yeah, I mean, what I would compare it to is some of the hacks that we've seen over the past couple of years, where there was a SOC involved and there was even potentially an outsourced MSSP SOC involved, but there was still that fatigue applying in both of those environments, and then a hack got through because they just weren't paying the right kind of attention to the alert that actually ended up mattering, because it was buried in amongst all of the other stuff that was flicking by. It's like, it's the same principles that apply to how you resource this sort of thing. so, internally as well.
So in terms of these false negatives, hand on heart, you can't tell me that you've never had a false negative at BugCrowd. So I'm just sort of wondering, can you tell us, you know, can you give us a post-mortem on when something might have gone wrong?
Yeah, difficult to prove because you don't want to prove a negative. I mean, the way that we get around that is two things. We make sure that everything that we've triaged out is still visible to the customer, and oftentimes the customer goes back through that and double checks it in their own time anyway. And we have, you know, spot reviews and different things like that. So you're absolutely right. Like, it's difficult to prove. Like, at this point, you're like proving a false negative. So that's like a triple negative at that point. So we're already getting a bit weird on this one. But yeah.
You know. So it becomes a bit of a Rumsfeldian proposition about unknown unknowns and all of that, right?
You don't know the unknown unknown that you don't know because you didn't think it was unknown or something like that.
Have you ever had one confirmed? I mean, like, you missed one in the initial response and then you found out later, oops, we should have been onto that?
Not that was within scope. So what we have had happen is is organizations that have, you know, defined a scope for their program and said, okay, these are the things that we want you to look at. These are the things that we're interested in. We've had hunters come in and, you know, either deliberately or you know, through like chains of, you know, systems they were touching or whatever, end up reporting against a system that wasn't within the primary scope of the program. We've gone back and said, okay, well, that's, you know, that's actually not in scope, but we still pass it through to the customer, and then the customer's come back and said, no, we actually want to pay that. That's relevant. That's something that we want to fix. So, you know, that happens every now and then. In terms of things where it's just like we completely cocked up and we got, you know, redressed by the customer on it, that's actually that hasn't happened at this point.
Now, Casey, another thing we're speaking about today is the CFAA. You've got a panel discussion coming up about the CFAA. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about CFAA and just really, you know, where it's up to, what it looks like in the future, like given some of my input in terms of, you know, what's needed on the business owner and the system owner side to be able to protect, but then also what's needed on the researcher side to be able to continue to do good faith security research, and really just where is all of this going to go next. Leonard from DOJ is on that panel as well, and obviously he's pretty deep in the weeds with all of this stuff, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that this CFAA stuff is still kicking down the road. I mean, a lot of people were predicting when services like BugCrowd launched that eventually there would be that case. Do you know what I mean? That would sort of nip bounties and particularly outsourced bounty companies, you know, nip the phenomenon in the bud. That hasn't happened yet.
No, probably it hasn't.
Too far past the point that you know, it's not a bud anymore. It cannot be nipped. It is interesting, isn't it, that we seem to have been relatively well served by the common sense of prosecutors, because I know people have overstepped boundaries in bug programs, but it, the DOJ just hasn't got involved, and customers have been pretty cool about not reporting stuff when it's, you know, borderline. Have you been surprised by that?
To an extent, yeah. I mean, especially, you know, given you kind of called it out, like there have been different instances that have surfaced publicly where, you know, there has been contention between the hacker and the customer in a way that, you know, could have been in scope for pursuit under CFAA. The fact that hasn't happened, all of those things have been resolved in one way or the other without the law getting involved, I think. To be honest, I'm kind of surprised about it and not surprised at the same time. I'm surprised because, you know, that law exists and people have been relying it for a long time. So the fact that, you know, this growth hasn't tripped over things is, you know, just by virtue of the math, a little bit surprising. But I'm not surprised because of, you know, really the awareness that's growing around all of this and people realizing, yeah, we need help. Like the hackers that are out there that are trying to help us out, we actually need that help. So maybe it's on us to you know, not fire the bullet too quickly.
So I guess, you know, the question becomes, because depending on who you talk to, we either need really, you know, the need for CFAA reform, particularly in light of things like bug bounties, it's either really pressing or completely unnecessary, depending on who you talk to. Where do you sit on that spectrum?
In terms of reform, I think it's absolutely necessary. That's, you know, as it exists right now, the CFAA is far too broad, and you know, to a degree, the chilling effect that it has on security research still exists. That said, my position on having, you know, laws that allow business owners and organizations to defend themselves against malicious hackers, I'm not of the opinion that those should be thrown out wholesale. I think there's just honestly a bunch of hard work that needs to go into it and a bunch of conversations and iterations that get us to a position that's more sane, where both sides feel like they're protected when they go off and have this kind of conversation.
Not acceptable. Where's my soundbite? Repeal it now, or everybody's paranoid. It's got to be one of the two, repeal. Man. Come on.
Well, you know, we can repeal and replace CFA, I'm sure. But, you know, it's probably going to be extended on as opposed to thrown in the bin entirely.
Oh, and Casey, there's been some changes at BugCrowd. You are now the CTO, not the CEO, which I'm guessing, does that mean more time just sitting around relaxing, drinking mojitos? Was that the idea?
That was 110% my plan.
How's that working out for you, pal?
No. It's been really good. I mean, we've gotten to the point where the business is growing to, you know, really the pace where, as a first-time CEO of a venture-backed company, I kind of took a look at it all and thought, all right, we're going to do better if I can focus on the things that I'm good at. And frankly, I'm going to do better as well because I'm, you know, doing the stuff that I enjoy more. And then take the business operations, the go-to-market, those other pieces that you know require like longer experience, and go out and find the right fit for the company to come and actually lead those things. So, we kicked off a search, interviewed a ton of people, and ended up finding Ashish, who has been fantastic. He's been in the seat now for 5 weeks, and I'm very happy. So he comes out of the CMO and EVP role at a company called Infoblox, which is a cybersecurity and infrastructure organization. He's done a bunch of stuff. He's been around the Valley for years and things like that, just in terms of his understanding of how business building in this part of the world works, but then also his experience with the cybersecurity industry and you know, especially marketing and go-to-market strategies. Like, he's coming in with a lot of experience there. Plus, he's just a good guy. Like, he's fit in. You know, BugCrowd is fundamentally a people company in terms of what we're working with and what we're trying to do. So having someone who would come in as a cultural fit was really important to me as well. And he definitely ticked those boxes.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that's all working out for you. Casey Ellis, thanks a lot for joining us on this week's show. And thanks for sponsoring this week's episode of Risky Business.
Thanks, Pat.
That was Casey Ellis of BugCrowd there. And that panel that we mentioned, that's taking place at an event organized by CyberScoop. It's called CyberTalks, a TED-like conference bringing together top cybersecurity experts. That's happening on Wednesday, October 18 in DC. So there you go. And you know what? You could worry about SOC fatigue and setting up robust triaging processes for your bug bounty program, or you can live a less stressful life by getting BugCrowd to handle it for you. You can check them out at bugcrowd.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.